This is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 9, and today I'm joined by Jill Gordon, who is currently professor of philosophy at Colby College, but in just a few days, on September 1st, she'll be the Charles A. Dana Professor of Philosophy at Colby College. So congratulations, Jill.
Thank you.
So I think you may be the first endowed chair. Well, you are the first endowed chair guest on Digital Dialogue, for sure. So Jill is the author of many articles on Plato and social political philosophy, and she's been a longtime member of the Ancient Philosophy Society, and she served a term there as co-director, during which time she oversaw a tremendous increase in membership and did an enormous amount to secure the long-term flourishing of the society. So there are many of us in the society who are grateful for your service there, Jill.
Well, thank you. It's really a pleasure.
She has written a book entitled Turning Toward Philosophy, Literary and Dramatic Structure in Plato's Dialogues, and that book focuses on the way Plato's literary techniques are designed to engage students and readers and turn them toward the pursuit of philosophy. So that text is actually a really important one for my project in thinking through the issues of or the nature of Socratic politics. And she is currently working on a text entitled tentatively, or is this a working title?
I can't even remember which one I gave you, so it's definitely tentative.
Okay, what I have is Erotic Matters, Reconsidering Platonic Dialogue and Socratic Method.
Okay. That's not the latest, but that will do.
Okay. So what is the latest?
I think it's something like Reconsidering Eros in Plato's World.
Okay, great. Well, actually, that's a great way to maybe begin our discussion today, because one of the things we wanted to talk about is what we mean when we speak of the erotic with regard to Plato and Socrates, because I'm imagining some people who might be listening may have a different conception of the erotic than we do when we talk about it in these terms. So could you talk a little bit about what you mean by the erotic dimensions of Socratic questioning or Socratic philosophical activity?
Sure. We can start on the more explicit level. Plato wrote several dialogues in which Eros is both a subject matter that the interlocutors talk about and could describe the relationships among the various interlocutors. They're either lover and beloved to each other or would like to be or something like that. Mm-hmm. And we learn quite a bit in those dialogues about what erotic desire is. And it is both something sexual between human beings, but also in those dialogues, it refers to a human desire for, and we could say here, the forms, noetic objects, that is, objects that we know through this faculty called noesis. In another way, I think that Eros manifests itself in a lot of other dialogues where it's not talked about explicitly, and that's primarily what I'm focusing on in my current work. And what I want to try to look at there is how we can think, sort of turn the tables a little bit about our understanding of erotic desire. Mm-hmm. What I mean by turn the tables is the following. We tend to think that Eros is primarily sexual desire, and that this desire that humans might have for something beyond ourselves, beyond our knowledge and understanding, is a kind of metaphorical understanding. Plato wants to say we desire the forms. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to do in my new work is to explore the ways in which Eros is both a cosmological force, but also a human faculty that precedes our embodiment, and therefore look at human sexual desire as a diminished and partial way of thinking about Eros.
Mm-hmm. So maybe you could talk a little bit more about that, because that's I've always associated the dimensions of Eros and the erotic with a kind of commitment to reading Plato and Socrates through the lens of a embodiment, and I'd like to hear a little bit more about that.
Right. So Some of my early work in this area focused on the dialogue Timaeus, which is a cosmological dialogue in which the character Timaeus tells a story about how the cosmos was created. And in that dialogue, we see that Eros is fundamentally there in the cosmos before humans come on the scene. Mm-hmm. Secondly, it's part of the divine soul that gets created for human beings before that soul is embodied. Mm. Now, this is nothing new when Plato is writing. We have, as you know, in Hesiod's work, Eros is one of the first three gods that's appears in that in his Theogony. Mm-hmm. And so there's a tradition preceding Plato to think about Eros in this way.
So does that mean, and I think this is really important insofar as, I mean, you see it also probably play itself out in Aristotle in a different kind of way. It's certainly when he speaks of a god as the kind of erotic principle itself. Mm. But in this sort of grand cosmological conception, can we think of this as a kind of the way in which beings or things are by nature in a certain way attracted to one another or stretch out toward one another? Even you could even think of this in terms of atoms and other kinds of things. Is that fair enough? Or
I think it is. Now, I'm not sure the text, Timaeus, will bear an extremely robust reading on that level, mm-hmm. but it certainly doesn't preclude it. What it does allow in a fairly strong way is a reading that says human drive towards noetic objects mm-hmm. is Eros. Okay. That is clear in the dialogue.
Okay. Maybe we could, since I'm really interested in sort of focusing on the way in which Eros is at play in the activity that Socrates undertakes when he is performing philosophy. What does your position about this grand cosmological or pre-human Eros do for our understanding of that, the activity of philosophy and how it is, I'm assuming, drawing from my knowledge of your other work, but also other things, that Socratic philosophy is informed by a kind of erotic dimension that draws him toward people and also toward turning them to thinking about the forms and other kinds of things.
Right. So I would look at two things that are very closely related. One is the role of asking questions, mm-hmm. Which I think is a fundamental erotic activity. And then also maybe we could talk a little bit about Socratic ignorance and what that means. I think that's also a kind of erotic stance. So one of the things we learn about Eros from the Symposium, which is one of those erotic dialogues where the participants talk very explicitly about Eros. One of the things we learn in that dialogue is that Eros is about lack, that we desire what we lack. Mm-hmm. And in that dialogue, one of the characters tells a kind of mythological story about the birth of the god Eros, and he is born to the parents Paeania, which is lack or poverty, and Poros, which is plenty. Mm-hmm. And what that dialogue tells us, and that myth in particular tells us, is that Eros takes on the qualities of these two parents. He desires that which he lacks, mm-hmm. And is in poverty in some sense with regard to the things he desires. But at the same time, he has abundant skills and resources to go after and seek that which he lacks, including, that is, his character traits include courage, fortitude, and I believe also a facility with logos or language.
Right. So, I mean, and this is a pretty good description of Socrates himself, right? I mean, in a certain way.
Exactly. And the Symposium does make allusions to Socrates' very person. That is, the descriptions of Eros do, in fact, in that dialogue, sound very much like Socrates himself.
Right.
So if you think about the mode of being, which I would call questioning, mm-hmm. Socrates does a lot of that.
Right.
questioning seems to be a lot about lacking and desiring. That is, we don't tend to ask questions when we think we know something. The only time we tend to ask questions, that is genuine questions,
right,
is when we're cognizant of having a lack, not knowing the answer.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you know, you've got to have the wherewithal, some sort of resources or drive, and I would say also sometimes courage, to know how to ask those questions and pursue the answers that you desire. So I think the mode of questioning, which is pervasive in the Socratic way of life and throughout Plato's dialogues, is a fundamentally erotic activity.
Mm-hmm. That I certainly agree with. And I think, I mean, on that level, you really have an articulation of the human erotic, that is to say,
yes,
right? So one dimension would be a certain kind of finitude, a certain kind of, let's say, recognition of one's own limits and mm-hmm. a desire to seek that which lies beyond limits. And I think in that sense, you have an important way of thinking about the pursuit of knowledge, the search for truth, that doesn't fall into the question of possession.
Exactly.
And ownership.
Right, right. And I think, you know, maybe we can come back to this if you want, but my reading of Plato is, it does not include philosophy as something that delivers humans answers in a sort of complete way, but rather it's a tool for limited beings such as ourselves to try to cope with our limitations and to live a certain kind of life in recognition of our limitations.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, one of the things that Marina and I talked about, I think, in episode 6 was trying to draw out this dimension of Socratic questioning that is not only rooted in the desire for some kind of understanding of the truth or of justice, but also a kind of questioning that involved or that always involves a testing of the self. So questioning as a kind of testing, but
yes,
one that is not simply oriented toward firming up answers that can then be foundations for things that are unquestionable.
Exactly. In fact, I think nothing is unquestionable for Socrates.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many moments in the dialogues where he says things like, you know, I'm absolutely committed to this, or, you know, I believe in word and deed. So he has conviction, and very strong conviction, as we know, convictions he's willing to sacrifice his entire life for.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we could also fairly say that he's willing to investigate those convictions with anyone at any time and to talk about them. And that's, I think, an interesting aspect, a kind of paradoxical aspect of how Socrates holds his beliefs and lives his life. It's both with strong, strong conviction, mm-hmm. but always openness to question at the same time.
Right. I mean, I think that goes to one of the things that I'm concerned to think more about and to flesh out a little bit more with regard to the way Socrates is depicted in the Platonic dialogues, which is, what are the sorts of characteristics of a life of questioning or a posture that allows for the kind of questioning that you're talking about, this erotic questioning? Because, I mean, you know, we talked actually on the last episode in talking with Shannon Sullivan about Noel McAfee's book. We started talking a little bit about what was going on in these town hall meetings and things. And since then, I actually went to the town hall meeting with Arlen Specter here in State College last week. And there's a way in which there's a posture and an unwillingness to ask questions, to be mm-hmm. open to a kind of response that is really problematic for the possibility of transformative dialogue, I think.
Right.
But there are experiences, I think, that are depicted in Plato's dialogues that show what happens when you have this recalcitrance or this inability of interlocutors to engage in the way that Socrates would want them to engage.
Right. And I guess I would respond in two ways. One is just by citing a couple of good examples. And the other is to talk a little bit about something that's not talked about very much that I'm currently working on, and that is fear and courage. So examples that come to mind, I think the most famous in the in Plato's dialogues are Callicles in the Gorgias and Thrasymachus in the Republic. And I think you're right. These are two characters who, you know, get pretty angry, and especially in Callicles' case, eventually just drop out of the conversation and essentially say, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Right. I mean, and both of those examples are examples where there's this really strong agonistic side to both of these characters, and there's never really any, or there's always a question of whether they really were ever committed to a joint pursuit.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess the issue of fear and courage, I'd like to talk a little bit about a passage in the Phaedo, which is one of my favorite passages in all of Plato. And I think it speaks to this issue of either being open to pursuing things, even though they're scary, versus kind of shutting down.
Right.
There's a moment in that. So this is the dialogue that focuses on Socrates' final hours in the jail cell before he drinks the hemlock. Mm-hmm. And he's surrounded by several friends, and they're talking about, of all things, whether the soul is immortal or not. And it's a dialogue in which fear, it just pervades the whole dialogue. It's mentioned several times in the dialogue, and it's clear that the interlocutors are fearful. Mm-hmm. They're fearful not just about what's going to happen to Socrates, but I think they're fearful about the possibility that philosophical investigation won't give us the answers that we desire.
Right.
So there's this crucial moment in that dialogue where two young men, Simmias and Cebes, are sort of whispering to each other in the corner. And Socrates calls them out on this, and he says, all right, guys, you know, what are you talking about? Speak up.
Mm-hmm.
And they're reluctant, and they say, well, you know, we actually don't buy your arguments. We think there's some problems with them, but, you know, we hesitated to bring it up because of your current condition, right? You know, he's going to die in a matter of hours. Who wants to say to him, look, your argument that your soul is immortal, you know, it doesn't hold any water.
Mm-hmm.
And Socrates encourages them to ask their questions nonetheless. And then the moment I want to talk about is actually, it's not Socrates who speaks, but Simmias. And Simmias presents this amazing metaphor where he says, okay, I'm going to go ahead and ask my question. And I want to ask my question so that I never regret not having done so.
Mm-hmm.
And he describes a metaphor for human life that's something along the following lines. We are on rough waters. Human beings are in rough waters. And we're clinging to whatever vessel is holding us. But if some firmer vessel, by which he means a better belief, a better conviction, one that holds water, or excuse me, in this case, doesn't hold
right.
water, comes along, then we should grasp that one firmly. And I love this metaphor because I think it tells us a lot about what's really at the heart of Socratic conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you cling to your beliefs, your convictions, but only insofar as they keep you afloat.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is you engage in dialectic conversation, you ask questions, you seek genuine answers, so that if a firmer vessel comes along, one that helps you to lead a better life, you're in a position to grab onto that one.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a wonderful metaphor. I wonder the other passage from the Phaedo that's important, I think, in this regard is when Socrates warns everyone listening to him not to become misologues, right? Not
right.
to be haters of the logos, haters of reason and rational argumentation. And I think one of the things that I wonder about and I worry about is that, how do you have the courage to and the openness to shift your boat, to use the metaphor that we were talking about before, namely be willing to swim a bit in open waters to get to a boat that might be, or a set of beliefs and ideas that might be more effective and, than you otherwise would. I mean, because I see a lot of people clinging to ideas that are just not very effective, and certainly cling to them in ways that are potentially very destructive. So, and here I am, I think, thinking about kind of current state of political debate, which may not be the best metaphor or the best context. I mean, one of the things that, that you mentioned that's striking me as pretty important is when Simmias says, you know, I'm going to say this, I'm going to have the courage to say this to you, Socrates, because I don't want to regret not asking you about it. I mean, there's a sense in which there's an important there's an importance of saying what we need to say to each other when we can and while we can, because and that I see much more powerfully in my interpersonal relationships with the with my kids and with my parents and with my colleagues than I do sort of in the broader political arena.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure I have a good answer to the question, you know, how do you help people to have that courage, or how does one muster up the courage oneself for that sort of thing? But I do think that in a really poignant way, Plato is very conscious of that difficulty throughout all of the dialogues. And I think in sort of two ways that are related. One, if we can go back to this notion of mythology in the Phaedo, you know, that passage comes up in the context of, you know, if you're someone who says, okay, let's try this philosophy thing, let's work on some arguments.
Right.
And then repeatedly the arguments fail or they don't get you to the answers that you had hoped, then you start to hate argument. And Socrates' metaphor there is it's like misanthropy, right? If enough people disappoint you, you start hating all people. But I think there's also a larger issue that is poignantly on Plato's mind. I think he writes with a very strong consciousness about the public's lack of stomach for difficult and complex and personally challenging dialogue. And these come out in more oblique ways in the dialogues. There are so many references to kind of along the following lines. Well, you know what happens to philosophers, right? which are veiled references to what happens to Socrates, but I think more generally are about the difficulty of having these kinds of conversations publicly.
Yeah. Well, you and you, I think, in some email correspondence we've had that have couched this issue also with regard to the current political situation in the United States in terms of a kind of anti-intellectualism. So when you're bringing up some of these meta issues about, look, how do we how can we cultivate an openness and between one another, and how can we allow the ambiguity of things and the grayness and the complexity of the decisions that we're making be there and be part of the debate without, you know, getting into you know, death panels and all the other stuff that gets talked about. It's difficult, and so one of the things that I've been trying to think about is, you know, how what's our role as educators and as philosophers, but also more broadly speaking as educators, in cultivating in our students the kinds of characteristics one might need to have in order to be open to differing opinions, different perspectives, without allowing those opinions and perspectives to shatter us to such a degree that we can't hear or think about alternatives.
Right. Wow. Well, the second is a hard question, and I'm certainly not someone who is anti-technology, but I do feel like some technological advances, or at least the way in which we consume media, plays some role. I'm reminded of a passage, I hadn't thought about this until just now, I'm reminded of that passage in the Gorgias, which is often referred to as a kind of interlude, or, you know, it seems not relevant to the main part of the conversation, although I think it is, where Socrates contrasts his current conversation with the lawyers in the law courts. And he says that one of the differences between his conversation with his interlocutors and lawyers is he has all the time in the world. He's leisurely. And I want to take that to heart. I think one of the things that destroys our ability to have meaningful exchanges has to do with the soundbite. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you cannot get a complex issue conveyed in a soundbite. It's just not possible. And so I guess I would want to explore ways in which contemporary technological media could be used to create dialogue in a more leisurely fashion.
Yeah, one of the things I've been thinking about is thinking about how do we slow things down so that we can think about them in a more reflective way. And I think there are certainly a lot of the technologies that I've been thinking about with blogs and with podcasting and other sorts of things there that they do open up the possibility, even though they're not always used in this way, of slowing things down. I think we really run into problems with some of the older kinds of media, like the cable news cycles and all of that, where there's just a constant, and they reach a lot more people than some of these Web 2.0 social media.
Right.
But they just are so interested in highlighting the agonistic dimensions and putting those front and center, because that's what people seem to want to hear about. But I wanted to ask you actually in this regard, and this is I think related to the Turning Toward Philosophy book. But what do you see as the kinds of strategies that Plato's using in his writing to get us to slow down and to get us to think about the kinds of things that Socrates is doing? Because I mean, you know, there certainly is something of a tradition in Plato scholarship that says, okay, what we need to really do is find the arguments and discern what those are and lay them out and put them forth that way. I think that's too much of a caricature of what contemporary Plato scholarship is about these days. But there are strategies, I think, that Plato's using, even with regard to Callicles and with regard to Thrasymachus in those examples where Socrates does, at least with regard to Callicles, take over the argument and try to sort of model a possible way of moving forward, even when you have an unwilling participant or someone who's just simply not willing to participate in a discussion.
Right. So I guess I could talk about several different strategies. I'll just pick one. I want to talk a little bit about Plato's use of irony. Before I do that, I just want to make one small comment about what we were talking about a moment ago with regard to current conversations. You mentioned the agonistic aspect of contemporary discourse. And I think it opens up really what is so wonderful about being able to teach Plato and how current he is, because, as you know, this is another issue for Socrates, is, you know, that the sophists are so interested in winning the argument and teaching bad logos habits.
Right.
And so, you know, maybe one answer to your question is to help our students through Platonic dialogues to think about ways in which the agonistic mode of approaching conversations is still a live issue today.
Yeah, and I think just to follow up on that a little bit, I mean, I think what you have in the classroom is hopefully a space where that agonistic posture can break down if you have the right kind of classroom culture.
Yeah.
The other thing, since we're circling back, and I happen to believe that the ability to circle back to things said before is part of the one of the excellences one needs to have in order to be good at dialogue or a good participant at dialogue. But I wanted to circle back to your point about fear and courage, because there is a way in which a lot of what we do and what we say is informed by fear. And getting in touch with what the source of that fear is really, I think, an important aspect of moving from a fearful position, which is inherently, I think, closed, to a more open position, which is more grounded and I think, secure. And that's one of the things I'd certainly felt in the room in the town hall last week and with Senator Spector was just an anger and a fear. And, you know, I just was realizing and just feeling the affect of those emotions and recognizing that just I myself started closing in on myself and saying, okay, I just sort of need to protect myself from this. And I think what Simeon says about being courageous and what Socrates continually comes back and sort of and encourages the students, look, have courage to say what you think and what you believe, and let's get it out on the table.
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, Socrates is fearless in so many ways. And I think we can look throughout history and look at the people who really were, if not professional philosophers, philosophical, and who engaged in genuine dialogue. They're fearless people in many ways.
Yeah. So let's get back to the you wanted to make a point about irony.
About irony. Yeah. So your question was, you know, how does Plato help to turn the reader towards the philosophical life? And one of the ways he does that is by using irony. So you've got several things going on different levels in the dialogues. Socrates certainly says many ironic things to his interlocutors. And what I find interesting is that sometimes those interlocutors get it and sometimes they don't. And so what Plato is doing is something quite interesting. He is allowing the reader to be in on a joke sometimes that the interlocutor is not in on. And so it creates initially a sort of distance between the reader and the interlocutor that allows something, which I'm going to talk about in a second, very interesting to happen. But then I think he also gives us the tools to close that gap and see that we're not so different. Mm-hmm. So let me take as an example this dialogue, the Meno, and tell you one instance where I think that is working. So Meno is, like many interlocutors, this guy who thinks he's smarter than he is. And he says to Socrates that he has given many fine speeches on many occasions to large audiences about what virtue is. Mm-hmm. It turns out in his conversation with Socrates, he really doesn't know what virtue is. At a later point in the dialogue, Socrates is doing a demonstration with Meno's slave. He's demonstrating some geometry. And it turns out the slave doesn't really know geometry very well, and he answers several questions incorrectly. And at this moment, Socrates turns to Meno, and he says, you know, well, have we made him better off or worse off? And he gets Meno to agree they've made the slave better off because now he knows that he doesn't know, whereas before he might have thought he knew something about geometry. And what Socrates says is the following. He says, before, he might have given many fine speeches to large audiences about, you know, if you double the length of the side of the square, you'll double the area. So what Socrates is doing is sort of playing back to Meno his very own words and essentially saying, you know, look, it's as ridiculous that this slave would be getting up and giving speeches to people about geometry as it is to imagine you giving speeches about virtue.
Right.
So if the reader sees that, her first reaction could be, oh, that's silly Meno. You know, he's so dumb, he doesn't get it, he's really ignorant. But then I think what Plato also does then is to give the reader the tools to say, oh, wait a minute, maybe Socrates' lesson is for me too. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm really ignorant about some things just like Meno. Mm-hmm. So I might be feeling really superior right now, but if I'm really going to take Socrates' lesson to heart, I better check my arrogance at the door and think twice about this. So that's the sort of thing I think that Plato is doing. And if you are reading a text that helps you to, I think, feel a little less arrogant, feel a little less secure in your knowledge of things, that's a first step toward asking some really good questions.
Yeah, no, I think that's an important point, and I think that you know, it speaks to one of the points that I think we were going to talk about, which is the manner in which and the ways in which Socrates often fails. And here's an example where he clearly fails with Meno, but the question is, does he fail with us? And that's the ongoing, I think, challenge of of reading the Platonic text. And it is also one of the reasons why I enjoy reading your work on Plato so much. So I really want to thank you, Jill, for coming on the Digital Dialogue, and hope that we'll be able to do it again soon.
Thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed it.